Hello and welcome to Cruise Club. We've got the need to podcast. This is episode 14, Far and Away from 1992. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Michael O'Manzi.
Oh, wow. Okay. So this is apparently, I don't know if you knew this, but this is a comedy in Ireland because of how bad their accents are.
Oh, I got news for you. It's a comedy in America, too.
It's a comedy everywhere. I mean, this is a great, great movie. But before we talk more about this movie, let's welcome in our guest, the host of the Not Her Again podcast. You may know him from his smash hit appearance on Too Fast, Too Forever. This very lap. Never seen a Fast and Furious movie before. Joe and I made him watch the first one. Big fan. I can tell you he's a big fan of these movies. He's watched them all since then, or has not watched another one. It's Michael Domenico. Hello, Michael.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here to talk about this very long movie. So here's the thing, Michael. I've said this to Mike both tonight about this movie specifically, and also as we recorded things in the past. But when the title card came up, Western Ireland, 1892, I said out loud, "Ah, fuck." And I was worried. And then I loved this movie. I laughed so much. I loved it. It's basically, I messaged Greg McLennan, our guest from last episode, Days of Thunder, the previous Kidman Cruise team up, and I said, I love this movie. And he said he calls it the Titanic on land, which I think he mentioned last episode.
Not a bad
call. And it kind of is. You know, the first thing I got to say is that it's crazy how stacked Tom Cruise's filmography is with good movies that no one talks about this movie. Of all the movies that people are like, oh my God, he's so good in them, this does not come up. And this is incredible. Like, this is a great movie.
Yeah, like, what struck me as so strange was I'm watching it and I'm like, man, this feels like it's going to be a chore. It really, I'm like, yeah, not in the mood. I am not ready for a Ron Howard 90s wannabe old-timey epic sweeping music and this. And by the end of it, I wanted another hour or something. I was so turned around within like 15, 20 minutes of this movie or something, like the first act, when I felt like I got a grip on it. I just was smiling like the whole rest of the way through. I just had such a good time watching the rest of it.
Michael, what about you? What did you think of this movie when we sort of assigned you of sorts a 2.5 hour Irish epic? Were you looking forward to this? Had you seen this before? And what did you think of it after watching it?
I had never seen it before. Was I looking forward to it? That's maybe a little strong. It is like 140 minutes. I don't know how specific you want me to get at this point, but I do think that the central issue for me with this movie is that it, like, really requires you, I think, to invest in the, like, Shannon and Joe stuff, which is Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. And I just, like, could not for the life of me figure out what their attraction was and why they cared about each other outside of, like, a lot of convenience. But, like, I didn't really get anything other than the fact that it was, like, super convenient for her to have this guy. I mean, I guess what, I kind of get why he was into her, because she's beautiful, but, like, she's not that interesting, like, honestly. So
presumably,
I didn't really get it.
Presumably, he's the first penis that she's ever seen.
Oh, yeah, definitely. They make that abundantly clear.
Favorite part. She looks twice. Double check. Yep.
So I did a little bit of research on this, because I was like, when did they get married? Like, when were they? And they were married during this movie. So between the time of Days of Thunder and this movie, they had gotten married. We don't generally go too far in depth into the actors that we're covering personal lives
stuff outside
like that.
The movie. Yeah,
there's a little bit of importance here, I think. So Cruise married Mimi Rogers in 1987. They sort of separated in 89 and then got divorced in February of 1990. They released a statement early on that said that there are a lot of positive aspects, but things could not be resolved after a long period of time. The important thing, I guess, the big notable event in their relationship is that she is the one that introduced him to Scientology. So it's because of her that the whole, all of that
all
happened.
All praise Xenu, right, yeah.
Yes.
What a claim to fame, you know?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so then, three years after they divorced, in 1993, Mimi Rogers is talking to Playboy, apparently, and said that Cruise was, quote, like a monk when it comes to their intimacy issues. And then she, I don't know if it was because of intimidation from the church or what happened, but she quickly retracted all that and said, no, I didn't mean it like that. That was taken out of context. So that's the whole Mimi Rogers saga, which we did not cover at all, I don't think. I don't even think we've said her name in these first 13-plus episodes. Oh. But Cruise and Kidman got married on Christmas Eve 1990.
Yeah.
So I guess they met on the set of Days of Thunder, possibly, or we had seen, what did I say last week, Mike, that he had seen her in another movie and wanted her in this movie, and so they got her for Days of Thunder. I guess they fell in love. They got married. So they're a married couple acting opposite each other in this movie. I can see where you're coming from, Michael, in terms of the, I don't know why she would be attracted to him, but I also, he's a scrappy young go-getter, and if, if the choice is him or this kind of doofy, entitled guy, Cruz got some stuff going for him.
Yeah, they just, like, for a married couple, have, like, not a lot of chemistry. I mean, like, off-screen. Like, they're married in real life, and, like, it doesn't really translate in this movie. Unless other people thought it did. But for me, I was just, like, outside of just, like, pure physical attraction, I didn't really see that much going on between the two of them. And I think part, a lot of it has to do with the writing, but I think part of it's also their performances.
Yeah, part of it for me is I felt like this is a type of movie where it's like, hey, these two people just got married and they're making a movie together. Like, they're in love. And, like, you bring your sort of public knowledge of their life into the theater with you, and maybe that's what they were banking on. It's like, hey, watch a real-life married couple fall in love on screen, and I don't think they have the chemistry they did in Days of Thunder in this, to be quite honest. I think this is just a little too played, a little too goofy, and not, if it was maybe played a little more serious, actually, I might have bought their relationship more, but then I wouldn't have bought a lot of the other stuff going on.
If this was more serious, I could not get through this movie, I can say that much.
But to one degree, you know, like, Tom Cruise's character is like, you know, he loves taking pain and abuse and all that shit, and like, she treats him like shit, like she's a big bully to him because of their class difference and all that kind of thing, and he just kind of takes it and whatever to get to America so they could get to the Oklahoma land race together and that whole thing, sharing a dream. But yeah, I bought them more as brother and sister in disguise than I did as people falling in love.
Yeah, me too.
Well, I think that's kind of, because it's not really, I mean, it's a love story, but it's not really a love story, because for most of it, they're not together. Right? Like, even at the end, when he finally gets the Oklahoma land rush, he sees her, he's like, oh, I'm cursed. Like, I can't get away from this woman that, you know, I have attraction to, but we're not meant to be together, we're not supposed to be together.
He can't even die to get away from her. She literally, like, comes back to life at the end of the fucking movie because of her.
It's those sweet, sweet genes, those Irish genes, bringing the men back to life once.
But no, I agree, Joey. Like, I actually would have wanted maybe more of them apart and none of their... it would have been cool if they just, for once, you know, there's a movie like this where they didn't try and do, like, a Jack and Rose romance kind of thing and all that kind of stuff. And, like, because it is very interesting when they're trying to be in America penniless on their own and, you know, they're working at, like, Tom Cruise is fighting for a living and she, you know, is, like, washing clothes, but then she does the burlesque stuff and everything. Like, it would have been cooler to maybe just see them go off on their own, and they do, but it's like the third act where she gets shot, he drops her off at the house, like they're forced apart at that time.
Yeah, I also just think that her character in particular is just like begging to have something more to do, because I think that this movie reminded me a lot in some ways of like Gone with the Wind, where it's this like big epic and it's these people who are kind of in love, I guess, going through this, like, big historical event. But at least with, like, Scarlett and Rhett, there's, like, Scarlett's such an interesting character on her own, and I don't think that Shannon is, like, remotely interesting. Because they try and make her be like, oh, she's independent, like, she's running away to America. But she's just, like, very passive the whole time. And, like, very reliant on Tom Cruise to do a lot of stuff for her. And I just feel like her character, they kind of want her to be, like, strong in that Gone with the Wind vein or something. But they don't want her to be too strong, so then they kind of dial back too much. Characters keep telling her it's her dream to go to Oklahoma. But I don't really get why it is her dream. Like, I just feel like her character needed to be more active and more aggressive, maybe, than they ended up writing her.
Well, I think what's strange about this is that she's introduced when Tom Cruise is sleeping in their barn after he's trying to kill her dad, and she's introduced by, like, riding into frame on her horse, and her mom yells out the window something to the effect of, like, you have to ride like a lady, like, you can't let people see you riding like that. So, like, she's got this independent sort of feisty streak in her, right? But we don't really see it. I mean, we see it a little bit, but we don't really see it. And I sort of agree with you there that, like, it would have been cool to sort of see more of her, you know, developed characterization, but I still think maybe, you know, I sort of chalk it up, maybe the fact that this is like 1890s and this is like what a woman is quote-unquote supposed to be or whatever, but I don't mind that as much. I would like to see a more well-rounded, fully fleshed out character, but I think that within the context of history and society, it works or kind of gets a pass in that regard. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I just, going back to that first scene though, this is what was weird to me, was that you go back to that first scene when she meets him and he's hiding in the stable wing to kill her dad, which we'll get into later, I guess. But he's waiting in the stable. You know, the mom yells at her, like, be like a lady, and you're like, ooh, I guess that she's not very ladylike. Like, ooh, like, I wonder how she's gonna, you know, be ahead of her time. And then she sees him, and she immediately runs out screaming that she was, like, raped by him when he hasn't even touched her. And I was like, wait, what's happening? I just felt like this constant push and pull with his character, where I was just like, what is this adding up to? Like, I didn't really get where she was kind of coming from. And she has moments that are, like, good, but then she has moments it's, like, always, like, a two steps forward, one step back kind of thing with her, in a way that felt, like, kind of disorienting and not complex in an interesting way, but just complex in a way that I was like, wait, why is she motivated to do that? Like, in a way that felt like she wasn't totally thought out or fleshed out the way that she should have been.
I definitely got that, like, especially in, like, the before they get to America, I was like, what's her purpose here? Like, what's going on? Like, all of a sudden, it felt like, oh, I'm running away. I'm going to America. Bye. And it's like, oh, yeah, right, sure. But, like, no, she really is running away and going to America. I'm like, wait, did I miss something? I didn't see this coming from her character quite yet. And then when she gets to America, yeah, she just, like, it just feels like she's grounded. Like, she, like, grounded in her room, kind of grounded. Like, she doesn't, like you say, get to do very much, or as much as maybe they could have given her to do there to make her more interesting. She gets to argue with Clint Howard about plucking chickens. It's like, great. I hear you there. I was definitely a little disoriented by that character.
Yeah, and not to compare it too much, but, like, just really quickly, I'll go on my one last comment with one tangent. But at least with, like, Scarlett O'Hara, by the time that she is independent, having to do things on her own, you've already, maybe this hour should have been 4 hours, or this movie should have been 4 hours, because by that point in Gone with the Wind, you've already had 2 hours with Scarlett to understand who she is as a person, whereas, like you're saying, Nicole Kidman, it's like, here are a few quick scenes, and by the way, she's running to America, and you're like, wait, what? Like,
yeah.
where did this come from? Like, whereas at least in Gone with the Wind, you've had so much time to sink into the character and see how she interacts with people and see how she manipulates them to understand why she's doing the things she's doing in the second half of that movie.
Yeah, I almost feel like she should have not run away to America until the villagers came to burn down the mansion, and that way maybe she would have had a little more reason to, or something, you know, like being driven out of the town. Because yeah, you're right about, like, I see them trying to do, like, those comparisons to movies like Gone with the Wind, but also, like you're saying, like, Gone in the Wind, she goes through, like, a whole, like, movie before she gets back with Rhett, and then they go through like that tumultuous marriage and the kid and everything with the horse, and it's just like, oh my god, you know, like, it just keeps going, and this movie just stops too. Like, it felt like if it wanted to, or in some way needed, like, a sequel or something that it was never gonna get, maybe it's just like half of
Eyes Wide Shut, baby,
there we go. Exactly, that is the official sequel now.
I think they play Shannon and Joseph Donnelly again.
Well, this is at the beginning of their marriage, and that's at the end of their marriage, right?
Oh yeah. So,
like, perfect bookend movies.
So Michael, what is your favorite part, if you had to pick a favorite part of this movie? I know there's stuff that you sort of would like to have been better, but if there's a favorite moment or scene or line, there's a lot in here that I love, but what's, if you had to pick a favorite moment, favorite thing about this movie, what would it be?
I think the thing that stands out the most is the beginning of the land rush sequence. It's just, like, actually pretty incredible what they pull off and how many extras and stunt doubles and all that they must have had, like, physically there that couldn't really be done with CGI yet.
I think I have those numbers. It was 800 really extras, 400 horses, 200 wagons.
Damn.
Yeah. It's incredible.
Nice going, Ron Howard. Like, I will say that this was a stunningly beautiful looking movie, and everything there is
beautiful.
Real. You can tell it's real, right? And I really appreciated that.
So now, Michael, I have a follow-up question to that, unrelated to the movie itself, kind of. It feels like everyone who's in the land rush is doing it wrong. It feels like Cruise has it right, where he's just, like, on a horse, a fast horse, by himself. I'm going to go plant this flag. I'm going to catch up to people, plant the flag. It seems like everyone who's towing all their earthly belongings is going to hit a divot and flip and lose everything. So my question to both of you, we'll start with Michael, is if you were in the Great Land Rush of 1893... what would be your strategy to get the land that you want? And I don't know if there's an actual answer to this question, because I feel like I would have no idea how to answer this question.
I mean, I think the answer is that you become... isn't that what Sooners are? They're the people who kind of snuck in illegally, and then they, like, knew which one they wanted, which is what her parents
did. Yeah, her parents.
That's why they call them Sooners instead of Boomers, and it's the Sooner state, because so many people were going and being like, oh, I just got here, but they had already staked it out. That's what you gotta do. You gotta stake it out before and basically cheat your way, because it's a total crapshoot, you know?
I also feel like, I don't know why, like, why would it be illegal other than just, like, I don't know why you shouldn't have, like, a scout team that can go find out what land you're literally going to be living on forever. Like, why is that not allowed? I guess it's just, they just didn't allow it?
They needed some kind of order, right? Like, they couldn't just... I mean, it is pretty much a free-for-all anyway, but at least, you know, here's a flag, here's, like, a little, like, map or whatever, and, you know, after that, it's like, best of luck.
Yeah, and, like, it's 1893, so there's not a lot of enforcement. If people are like, I'm just gonna go scout and be really honest about it, it's like, how are you gonna scout and then make sure that these people aren't actually taking their flags and planting them before everyone else gets a chance to? So I feel like it's just, like, practicality when they're like, we don't have drones, people. We have, like, 20 guys on horseback. You have to just wait.
All right, so idea for a movie. It's a remake of The Great Land Rush, or not a remake, but, like, a reimagining where there's one guy with a drone, and then he becomes the Emperor of the West.
Incredible.
Mike, what about you? What was your, do you have a favorite part of this movie, favorite line, favorite moment, favorite scene?
You know, I was kind of joking earlier when I said, you know, when Nicole Kidman took her peeks at Tom Cruise.
Oh, so long. That is hilarious. So real quick. Okay. So apparently Ron Howard was not getting, this is according to IMDb trivia, this is the top trivia on IMDb. He was not getting the facial reactions that he wanted from her when she was lifting the dish and seeing his junk. The scene, for those of you who have not seen the movie, is that Tom Cruise is stabbed in the thigh by Nicole Kidman with a pitchfork after she finds him in their stable. And so they kind of, it's sort of a little bit like, oh God,
Back
what's that
to the
movie?
Future?
No. What's that movie?
It's so Back to the Future, though. That's what I was thinking when
the
Marty's...
remake, the recent one, the one with Colin Farrell, that was the remake of the Clint Eastwood movie.
The Beguiled?
Yes, The Beguiled.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of like that, where they're like, we're going to lock him up in this room. We're going to kind of go about our business, but we're going to let him mend. They have him up in this room, you know, they've got his leg bandaged or whatever, but they have him fully naked head to toe with just like what seems like kind of like a bedpan, I guess, just over his junk. So you see his, like, ripped 25-year-old body or whatever, just like a big old dish over his junk. And she peeks a couple times, like we said before. So Ron Howard was not getting the reactions he wanted from her, so he said to Tom Cruise, take off your underwear. And he didn't tell Nicole Kidman, and then so she actually saw him, and then that her reaction was real. And because, you know, her husband still, but not, I guess still not expecting to see his dick
on set
while filming this movie. But
I feel like that is just like textbook sexual harassment these days.
Oh, yeah. Sure, like, but also, it's married. They're married. I mean, it's still not that it's not, but it's different.
No, I mean, they are married. It is different if they're married, I think. But I'm like, wow, this story would not fly in like 2019. People wouldn't be like, aww.
Right. Yeah, I don't know, like, if they were married today, I guess there'd still maybe be an issue. I don't know. Like, it's funny, but it's also like, okay, all right.
It's just weird that it was Ron Howard telling him to do it. I think if Tom Cruise had decided to do it, it would be less weird. I think it's weirder when another man tells you to do it, I think is, like, the issue that I'm having.
I would
I'm
agree
like,
with that.
That's the part that feels weird about it. Like,
I think that's fair.
Because I'm sure Tom Cruise would know her, you know, reaction to it anyway, you know.
Mike, what about you? Did you say a favorite moment? I know you like the peeking.
So I have, like, my real favorite stuff about this movie is definitely, you know, how, from as far as I could tell with my primitive eyes, is that it's all real. Like, they shot in real locations and these real mansions and, like, all these real horses and extras and all that kind of stuff. And this the cinematography is gorgeous. And, like, all of that combined, I think, was, like, half of why I was really into this movie, you know? Because, again, like, I'm not... It's a whatever kind of... Like, there's no real, like, love story for me here going on. And it's more just about, two people trying to not starved to death, you know, in early America. That's what I clang to. It's almost like an Eastern, not like a Western, you know, but like all the stuff takes place like on the East Coast, but it is the 1800s and stuff. So that to me is very fascinating. The realness of it, like, really bled through the screen for me. Like, I really give Ron Howard a lot of credit with, like, his geography, his location, and all that kind of stuff, you know. I'm not quite sure he got the tone right, but it's still enjoyable.
I think, you know, I agree with you, like, the tone might be off, but I think because the tone is off is the only reason, not the only reason, but, like, the main reason I enjoyed this. Because I was expecting a dry, like, historical epic, and I was blown away by just, like, how weird and goofy it was. Because my favorite moment, a couple different things that I really liked. The first line that I was like, oh, I'm going to like this movie. The movie starts with Tom Cruise as a poor Irish farmer, and, like, there's this tension. Like, the opening title card is, like, farmer versus landowner, and poor guy sticking up against the rich guy, and, like, the rich guy is taking advantage of all this different stuff. Tom Cruise's family is not paying its rent, and so Tom Cruise's dad dies, and then comes back to life, and then dies again. And as they're carrying him to be buried, we now know that Nicole Kidman, sort of betrothed, you know, slaps them with an overdue rent notice, basically, and then sets their farm on fire. And so Tom Cruise decides that he's going to go kill Kelly, who's Nicole Kidman's dad. We don't know this at the time. Nicole Kidman's dad, because he wants to get back at the man who, like, basically ruined everything that he has. And he's a landowner of Tom Cruise's farm. He goes to this bar, and he sort of stakes out Kelly. Then he goes to this graveyard. Kelly's, like, drunk, but, like, Cruise can't shoot him because the horse pulls him away. And at one point, Tom Cruise just says, "This is a difficult murder." And I just laughed out loud. And I was like, oh, if this is the kind of movie that we're watching, I love it. And then, you know, we said earlier that when Cruise is hiding in the stables and, like, you know, Nicole Kidman throws the horseshoe and it lands and doesn't hit him. And then, like, she stabs a pitchfork, like, right next to him. And, like, I cracked up at that, too. Like, there were just a bunch of different things. And then, again, the peeking and everything like that. There were just a lot of things that I loved. Like, Nicole Kidman climbing into his window. Like, I'm here to rescue you. And he's like, I don't know who you are. I don't like you. I don't trust your family. Get out of here. But, like, she, like, stumbles into his room and then, like, has, like, this great physical pratfall. And then quickly regains her composure. Like, there's so many little acting moments, like funny lines and like funny gestures and everything like that, that I just love. The only other one I want to point out now is that when Cruise becomes this boxing star in Boston, there's this woman at the boxing club that he's at. It's like a sort of a brothel boxing arena, whatever. And it's this woman, Grace, who's a burlesque dancer and I guess maybe a prostitute, I'm not sure.
A burlicue.
She comes over and she's kind of flirting with him, and he's up in the window with Nicole Kidman, and they're posing as brother-sister. She's saying, oh, do you want to go to church with me? And he's like, yeah, I'll be happy. We can sit in the same pew. It's going to be great. She leaves, and Nicole Kidman says she's got an awfully large chest to be going to church. And Tom Cruise says, Shannon, all chests are equal in the eyes of the Lord. And I died. I loved it. I loved it so much. I love that line. It's so goofy. Like, it's so funny and just so weird, and I love it.
Yeah.
I think when I caught on was how many times and how horribly wrong it goes for Tom Cruise to try and kill that one landowner. Like, after he, like, gets his wits about him again, he comes right downstairs and, like, falls down the stairs, like, on, you know, like, onto his face like an idiot. And then he's, like, trying to sneak around the corner and shoot him, and he, like, the gun goes off, like, next to his ear or something. And then there's that whole thing with the duel in the fog. I'm like, what is happening?
And this the dad's movie, like, on his side. He's like, I don't want to be doing this either.
Yeah, so it's just, it keeps running with that, luckily, like, thankfully. And, like, it is funny. Like, that's the funny thing, is, like, I was surprised how funny this movie actually is.
Also, let's never forget that this is a movie in which nothing can't be solved by punching it, including the moment where Tom Cruise punches a horse for acting up and tames the horse by punching it in the face. Like, I can't, I don't know how to respond to that other than, like, I was like, okay. You win, movie.
I mean, it's
basically
now the movie that Tom Cruise punches a horse in the face. Like, that's what Far and Away is to me, you know?
Yeah, and I did that in, like, Red Dead Redemption 2 once, and the horse had a very different reaction.
Oh,
and it was a mistake, and it was a whole thing, and I had to calm her down. I was like, Jessica Lange, the name of my horse. I was like, Jessica Lange, like, come on. I did not mean to do this. You know me. It took a lot of effort to get her back.
It's like Blazing Saddles, right? Like, that's what happens. It's like the real deal, though.
I also want to point out one of maybe the finest moment in this movie is that after Nicole Kidman, so they go to the boxing club. It's the night of the big fight. This guy has staked a lot of claim in Tom Cruise. He, like, bet big on Tom Cruise. Cruise is like, I'm not fighting. You know, my quote-unquote sister is acting like a burlesque dancer. I need to get her out of here. My mind's distracted. The guy says, I'll split the winnings with you. If you fight and you win, we'll split the winnings. And Nicole Kidman's like, oh, by all means, fight, because we're going to be set for life if you do this. And so he fights, but things go awry because there's sort of some nonsense. And, you know, the guy who bet on him is now also expecting sort of, like, sexual favors from Nicole Kidman. And there's a whole murkiness. And so Tom Cruise loses the fight. And so as punishment for losing what I guess is sort of a sure, like a slam dunk fight, this also is, you know, art imitating life, or life imitating art, now that Justin Bieber wants to fight Tom Cruise. Like, I don't know, you know, there's a lot of boxing things going on, both in this movie and in real life. Anyway, they get kicked out of their apartment, they get robbed, they lose all their money, they go sneak into this big mansion, they sort of pretend that she's, like, this wealthy woman again, that he's her servant, they kiss for the first time, you know, this is, like, their gesture of love, this is where they're actually connecting, they get caught, they get found out, they get chased out, and then she gets shot in the back as they're escaping. And so he brings her to her family, who's now also in Boston. And the finest moment of the movie is that it seems like he literally runs from Boston to the Ozarks over the span of 8 months, that he sprints through the cold and snowy winter, smash cut to Ozark Mountains 8 months later. And if that's not one of the finest Tom Cruise running moments of all time, I don't know what is.
Very, very true. He does. There's a whole other movie in there. What happens in those 8 months, you know? There's like this whole scrappy story, but we don't get to see it. Again, this movie had to be another 140 minutes.
Yeah, I was a little bummed when we jump that far ahead in time, pick up like so far away and like in a completely different situation, and he seems settled and something different about him. And I was like, oh, I kind of feel a little shortchanged.
Do you mean so far away or so far and away?
So far and away, exactly. Ooh. Yeah, that's incredible. But that was great running. You know, I didn't think, it's funny because they keep talking about the land race throughout the whole movie and stuff. And I was like, oh, is that when he's going to run? Is it going to be a foot race? Like, I really had.
I really, really hoped that, like, the horse again, like, because he has a horse that dies. I was like, please let this horse. I don't want to wish ill on a fake horse, but, like, please let this horse die and then have him sprint and beat him there. Like, that would be great.
Yeah, but so I don't think we've seen him running in the snow yet. So that was good. That was nice.
But I do think that that smash cut to 8 months, like, I love the fact that, like, he literally runs the Ozark Mountains, seemingly. But that's my least favorite part of the movie, where, like, I think the movie, because I feel like they were starting to click there, like, when their relationship was sort of starting to work out. And I know that you kind of have to, like, break apart there, if you will. But I feel like that's where the movie really kind of, like, slams on the brakes. Like, it jumps ahead, but, like, it slams on the brakes. And, like, when they separate, I feel like there's part of the movie where, like, it doesn't feel like have the same magic that it had up to that point. And I love where the movie gets, and I love the way that it ends, because it's weird and, like, fits in this weird world. But I think that, like, that pivot point where they go 8 months ahead, and she's now settled in the Oklahoma Territory, and he's in the Ozarks. I feel like that whole part of the movie, like, that transition, and I think maybe, you know, like what Michael's been saying, like, there's got to be more here, because it feels like we're missing so much good stuff. And it feels like here, just all the details, all the nice interactions, all the character development that we had seen over the previous, like, 2 hours, or hour and a half, or hour 40, or whatever, kind of feels like it goes out the window here, and it's kind of a bummer.
Yeah. It also starts to become very convenient, in a way, where it's like, I guess maybe it's trying to say something about, like, fate, but he ends up on the train, and they're like, the other guys are like, oh, this is Oklahoma. He's like, this is Oklahoma, which is a huge state. And he's like, I guess I'll get off here and participate in the land rush. And you're like, wait, what? Like, are you sure that you're in the right part of Oklahoma? Because it's not, like, small. But anyway, and then he, like, ends up there, and, like, Nicole Kidman happens to be there. Also, right before that, her family, like, happened to be in Boston looking for her at the exact night that she was shot, and just, like, all the stuff where you're like, ooh, it starts to get a little too convenient. And it's a movie already with some conveniences, but it's getting a little too convenient for everyone here, that everything just keeps being like, oh, would you look at that?
I mostly agree with, like, both of you guys, is that, like, it feels like it fast forwards at that point. Like, it really seems like it's finally trying to build, like, some of the romance that it's been promising the whole movie, where it's like, oh, like, they're alone, they're penniless, they're breaking into a house, they're pretending it's a fantasy, they're gonna kiss, like, it's all magic and everything. And then she gets shot? You know, it's almost like the movie's like, psych! Fast forward, we're gonna cut out, like, 8 chapters of this book that, I don't know if it is an adaptation, but I'm just, it feels like, oh, we have this book, we don't have enough money and time to do the whole thing. We got up to, like, chapter 20, like, 30 chapters here. We can only afford to do 4 more. Do we do the last 4 or the next 4? Well, we got to include the race, right? You know, once we skip ahead 8 months, it feels like we're on autopilot. It just feels like boom, boom, boom. Just get to that race, get this movie over with. And I want it to breathe more at the end here. I mean, like, it earned it. Like, it finally won me over, and now it's sort of, like, kicking me out the door or something.
It doesn't look like this was based on a book. It looks like it was an original idea for the movie. So I agree with you that it feels like an adaptation, because it feels like there's so much story here that they're covering so much of, but they're missing other parts of.
Like, I'm really amazed how well, like, it shifts when they get to America, and, like, he becomes the prize fighter. I was like, whoa, like, I really did not see that coming. Like, it was taking all these twists and turns, and then, yeah, that last act just becomes, like you were saying, like, very convenient, basic, just, like, you can totally see what's coming. Like, we still get the great race. Like, the land race is great visually and all that kind of stuff, but it's just like nothing really feels like it's building anymore or trying to grow anything. Like, the characters feel like they've gotten to a place and they're gonna stay there for the rest of the movie.
Is that your least favorite moment of the movie? Is it the transition there, or is there something about this that you like less than that?
Yeah, probably just that. Like, I did feel like a little gypped when it said it skipped that far ahead, because honestly, I don't know that it needed to. It could have just been like a month and a half or even 4 months, and I might have it might have tasted better in my mouth. You know, like, there's just something like 8 months, really? And, you know, it's like with Dark Knight Rises, like 8 years, like 4 years, five even. But yeah, I think for me, it just kind of, you know, started to pull me back out.
And Michael, what about you? Is that your least favorite part of the movie, or is there something that you liked less other than, I guess, the overall lack of development for Nicole Kidman's character? But if you had to pick a least favorite part of this movie, what would you say that is?
My least favorite part of the movie is when her parents come over to America, right? And her dad is the guy that Tom Cruise is trying to kill, because his dad is, like, the landlord. They're, you know, oppressing all these, like, Irish farmers and whatever. Her dad gets, like, zero comeuppance in the entire movie, and he cheats his way into the Oklahoma thing, which is exactly what I said my strategy would be, but I'm also not a landlord, so it's okay when I do it, because I'm on the right side of history. He's, like, cheats, gets the land, the exact land that he wants with his wife, and, like, everything's hunky-dory for them. And I was like, wait, what? I want to see this guy have, like, some kind of something happen to him, because he's, like, part of this, like, really oppressive system. And this movie started out with Tom Cruise exacting a vengeance on him for him burning down his father's house. Everything's, like, fine. And I was like, wait, what? Did they forget about these characters?
He did feel like the kind of guy where, like, a horse was gonna, like, maim him or cripple him somehow, right?
Yeah, I didn't need it to be, like, excessively violent. I just thought he'd be dead by the end of this, not, like, rewarded for, like, the horrible crimes he committed in Ireland.
I feel like, and I'm not sure if this is actually, if this works or not, but I feel like the movie wants to sort of portray her dad as not necessarily a good guy, but not a bad guy. Like, he's just sort of like a rich guy in Ireland who's on the other side of the war, of the battle, or whatever, from Tom Cruise. I feel like the movie really wants to position Stephen, who's the betrothed, you know, the guy that Nicole Kidman, I guess, is sort of promised to or whatever. It makes him the villain. Whether or not that works for you is, I guess, to be determined, but I think the movie isn't really saying her dad is bad, because I feel like in the duel, he's kind of showing, like, a nicer, softer side. Maybe that's because he thinks that Tom Cruise is about to die. I don't know. I feel like the movie wants him to be sort of okay-ish, the Stephen, to be the guy that you root against. And so in that regard, you know, Stephen doesn't really have any kind of comeuppance either. He just doesn't get the land that he wants, and I guess he loses out on Nicole Kidman. I don't know. Like, I don't really have too much of a problem with the dad not having a comeuppance. I feel like the fact that he doesn't have one at all and Stephen doesn't really have one kind of combined isn't great, but I don't know.
I guess it's my, like, intense class warfare instinct. I was like, this guy, good things cannot happen to him in this movie. And then this movie was like, good things happen to landowners who are rich. I was like, no. That is not the story I want to be told. I want to be told of a vengeance story against this one specific guy, whether he had good intentions or bad intentions. But, you know, I also maybe got carried away.
This is the cinematic equivalent of you against Jeff Bezos moving Amazon's headquarters into New York. Like, no.
Oh my God, yeah, it actually is, though.
Could have just had, like, it just been the folly of Tom Cruise trying to shoot him over 2.5 hours, right? Just, like, bumbling that move.
Wait, that would be a great movie.
Like, live, die, repeat. Just him trying to shoot the landowner the whole
That's
time.
An amazing movie concept. Just, like, him literally not able to kill this old man who, like, can barely walk.
And Joey, like, you mentioned the Steven character. Like, yeah. I totally forgot about this doofus until you just, like, yeah, where was he most of the movie? Like, you know, they really build him back up at the end as super important, and he's there in the beginning and stuff, but, like, they rarely cut back to Ireland, and when they do, I don't remember seeing him around, and all of a sudden he's searching for her in America, and then he's out there and at the land race and everything, and yeah, he looks like a good old-fashioned dastardly villain with his mustache and all that kind of stuff and his crappy attitude, but there's a character that they really just sort of, to me, felt like, oh, we need this presence here. It felt like it should have been someone from the fighting hall, right? Like, it should have been, like, Chief O'Brien or someone from Star Trek, like that guy who was, you know, one of Tom Cruise's backers who played him.
Or like Cole Meany from Con Air.
Like someone else, right? Like, I don't know. This guy, I don't know. He wasn't doing it for me.
A little weird bit of trivia is that the actor who plays Steven was born the same day in the same year as Tom Cruise. So they're basically the same person. So that's a thing. That's weird, right? I also looked up Grace, who is the chesty burlesque dancer. She's been in a bunch of, like, crazy B movies like Waxwork, which is awesome, and Dr. Giggles. But I think she maybe most is known for the Blame It on Rio movie where she dates Michael Caine.
Okay. Yeah.
And I think she's, like, naked the entire movie from what I've gathered up online.
I was like,
she's so pretty and sort of bubbly, and, you know, I wanted to see who she was, and I was like, oh, like, she's been in, like, really weird, kind of cool stuff. And then also this movie that I haven't seen, Blame It on Rio, where, you know, Michael Caine is an old dude sleeping with, like, a 20-year-old or whatever. So
his best friend's daughter. It's,
cool.
Yeah.
It was like that awesome. Movie Adore with Naomi Watts. Did you, either of you see that one where it's like
oh, no,
moms?
I've heard of that one, though.
Oh, uh-huh. Boy. Oh, boy. How Did This Get Made covered it, so I finally watched it for that. It's like two moms, I think, want to sleep with the other's like sons. It's yeah. this weird
oh,
premise.
Oh, okay,
but, yeah.
okay.
Go see that. If you're into that kind of movie, I guess it's good. I don't know.
That's with Robin Wright? Is that with Robin Wright?
I think it's Robin Wright okay. and Naomi Watts, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I was it's getting sort Naomi of a... sort of a Wesley and Buttercup vibe from Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman in this movie a little bit when she's like servant boy, like, you know, slave, like all this stuff to him early on, right? You could be my servant. I was just like, he's going to be the next Red Pirate Roberts one day.
Whenever I hear someone say slave, I just think of David Cross in
oh,
Mr. Show, where Bob
Odenkirk
plays the minister, and he's just like, no, I have to do this. Oh, slave... eat this glass. So yeah, so this is a movie in which Tom Cruise dies. Like he, so at the end of the movie, he's on a really fast.
I mean,
horse.
Not really.
Well, he dies. He does die. He gets
for a few seconds.
A horse. So hold on. Let me set up the scene. He's on a very fast horse. He catches up to Steven. He catches up to Nicole Kidman. There's a plot of land that Steven has found that he wants, and so Tom Cruise beats him there, and he says, "This land is mine." Mine by destiny, and he's about to stake the claim, and then I guess he's like, I don't know if this is the life that I want. Like, we don't really know. And I guess before I go further, like, why do you think he doesn't claim that land? Is it because he's afraid of commitment, or he doesn't think he deserves it, or he doesn't think that he deserves Nicole Kidman? Like, why doesn't he take that land?
I think it's the deserving Nicole Kidman part. Yeah. I don't know. That's how I read it in the moment. Where, like, because what else would he be debating in his head? But he keeps telling her, he's like, you know, go on without me, blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't want you to, like, lose your family over me. You have this guy who's terrible and I've, like, actively tried to kill. But, like, you know, you should totally be with him. And it feels like that's kind of the conflict, but it's not super clear. But that's kind of what I thought the movie was, like, telling me was that that was his hesitation.
Yeah, I was super confused, to be quite honest, at that moment. I was like, what is he waiting for? Like, this is like everything to him. And like throughout the whole movie, even Nicole Kidman's like, you know, people tell me this is my destiny, but right, she's the one who said, but it's like not really my destiny, or that comes up. And Tom Cruise is like, what am I really doing out here? You know, do I really want this land? Like, I'm a prize, you know, like there's other ways to make money and make a life and a living. So maybe at that point, like, he doesn't want it, or he sees Nicole Kidman and is like, I can't truly provide for her. Like, this should be for her. Did he already get run over by the horse too? Maybe
no
he's
so not
dying.
Yet not yet.
Okay, because I was gonna say my last ditch thing was like, oh, I'm dying, what good would I do owning this land, kind of thing.
No, so what happens, he's about to stake the claim, he does not. Steven's like, oh, this is my moment, this guy's not gonna do it, I'm gonna go do it. So then he races toward it on his horse. Tom Cruise is like, oh shit, doesn't put the flag on the ground, instead jumps on Steven's horse, tackles him off the horse, but then the horse falls on Tom Cruise. I thought he was gonna get paralyzed. Like, I thought that, like, he was gonna live, like, be paralyzed or whatever, and that she was gonna, like, that was some kind of, like, Twilight Zone-y twist or whatever, I'm not sure. The horse pins him, slams his head on a rock in the ground, and then he dies. But just like his dad in the beginning of the movie, he is brought back to life, then he and Nicole Kidman, I guess, get the land, because Steven runs off? It's a weird, like, it's a very quick, abrupt ending. Like, with the over-the-top score, I kind of like it. Like, it's kind of cheesy, but I also kind of like it.
It didn't, I mean, I wanted it to work really bad, but I was expecting there to be, like, a fight to the death or something, right? Where, like, they kill each other, and Nicole Kidman is about to, like, stake the claim, and then he, you know, she kisses him, and he floats back into his body, and they do it together or something. It just, as climactic as it was, it didn't feel as grandiose as I was expecting, I guess. At that point in the end, I thought that it was, I don't know, someone was going to get shot, something more brutal might be happening, but, you know, he does die. So, I mean, it goes very far.
A horse falls on him, he slams his head into a rock. That's pretty brutal.
Yeah,
you don't survive that. I was no. like, oh, he's definitely dead. And they were like, then the music came in where it was like, ooh, ah. And I was like, oh, what? And he was like, I'm alive. And I was like, are you sure you don't have, like, brain damage, though?
Well, he does say, and I quote, I feel myself dying. I'm like, oh boy, like that's a line. That's a hell of a line.
He's like, I don't know if the viewers know this, but I'm dying because I was hit by a horse in the head. And it's like, yeah, I think we probably assumed that you weren't going to make it out of that one.
In case you didn't see the rock covered in his blood, the back of his neck dripping in blood, the fact that he can't stand up, Yeah, I think he's dying.
So then what the hell happens when the camera, like, cranes back from his head as if it's his soul leaving his body, and then Nicole Kidman, like, kisses him or something, and it just, like, swoops back in, like, his soul re-enters, and his eyes open.
Him.
It's insane, though. Like, it's he's bleeding to death. How much longer is he gonna be alive? Like, a day, two? And then
it's like the animated movie Tangled.
Oh, okay. So it's like a magic kiss, and he's all healed, and they're gonna go live forever.
Oh my god, this movie. The fact that gimmick not only happens, like, once, but twice in this movie, where someone, like, dies, but then is like, just kidding. You're like, what?
I feel like in the movie's defense, that the fact that it happens at the beginning sets up the end. Like, if it just happened at the end, you'd be like, wait, what? The fact that it happens at the very beginning establishes, through some kind of weird precedent, that, like, this is okay in this world? I don't know.
Or that it's possible. But also, is it some kind of stereotype about the Irish that I'm not aware
of? Okay, right. This movie, I was, like, thinking about into, that.
I don't think so.
Because it exploits just about every other stereotype about the Irish. From
it
the
felt like they were, like,
the
magical
drinking
leprechauns, almost, that are like, we actually are immortal. And I was like, wait, what's happening?
There's, like, he's Sweeney Todd, or whatever his name is, Mad Sweeney from American Gods, right? Like, he is one of these magical immortal folk of the plain, or whatever they're called. But, like, because you know, the accent, the fighting, the drinking, I'm just like, man, this is really leaning into all those stereotypes.
I don't think they mentioned potatoes, though, so it's not all the boxes, just most of the boxes.
Oh my god, no, they mentioned potatoes once. There is a potato reference where someone's someone's talking about, like, what they'll farm one day, and they mention potatoes as an option. And I was like, classic.
This is also a movie that has a boxing montage, which is great. Like, it's just this cool boxing montage that Tom Cruise... So Tom Cruise, in the middle of this movie, becomes a boxer. Like, he's been boxing with his brothers growing up, I guess, and just, like, you know, annoying asshole older brothers, and so he's got this, like, fighting background. So to make money in America, he walks into this club and just knocks a guy out. They're like, oh, okay, I guess he can box. Then there's a boxing montage where he's very successful, but the best boxing in this movie is when... So he and Nicole Kidman are sharing a room, and they're posing as brother and sister, because otherwise it's scandalous, I guess. And so he's sleeping on the floor, she's on the bed. They're having, like, this sort of sexual, like, sexually charged kind of moment, I think. And he hears above him a couple having sex in this hotel, and he's like, I can't take this. Mm-hmm. And he sprints out of there, runs to the club, and just, like, wants to fuck shit up. And I was just like, this is so good. Like, it's just, like, his literal release from all of this. Mm-hmm. That he's gonna go punch dudes in the middle of the night, and that's when Grace brings him home, and he sort of starts this, like, maybe kind of affair, or fling, or just flirtation with Grace. But I love where he's just laying in bed, can't hear the sounds of people having sex above him, and then just sprinting to go beat dudes up.
Yeah, and when he knocks that guy out, he, like, creams his pants, like, clearly, like, it's in his face. Like, it is a vinegar stroke face on his countenance there. But also what I loved about that montage is, you know, he single-handedly, like, reinvents boxing in America. Like, everyone fights in, like, that old-timey stance, you know, like, the bare knuckle with, like, your two arms, like, far out in front of you, and, like, they're rotating. You know, I'm doing it now. You can't see it because this isn't a visual medium, but, like, Conan O'Brien usually, like, dances around like that and throws fake punches and stuff. But, you know, that old mustachioed style and everything. And in comes Tom Cruise with his, like, wild Irish fighting, dodging and uppercuts and, like, kidney punches and just all kinds of new ways to beat guys down.
I also like how this is clearly just, like, a test run for Ron Howard to do Cinderella Man in, like, 13 years.
Which I love. He's, like, trying it out. Can I do boxing? Can I sort of do soft, fuzzy focus? Oh, I can? Okay, yeah.
Can I do period boxing? Like, specifically period boxing. Not any boxing. He wants to set it back in, you know, the old days.
Also, I can totally see Russell Crowe as the Steven role. You know, like a younger, sort of thinner.
That would have been better.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently, Sean Bean was considered or something for that role, but he turned it down or just didn't get the part or whatever. But I can also see Sean Bean in that role. I don't know who this guy... I don't know who the guy is who plays. Like, I don't know what I've seen him from. He was okay.
Isn't he, like, the Criminal Minds guy or CSI or something?
Oh, is it?
Yeah, okay. Criminal Minds.
And he's, like, the personal bodyguard or something of the family? Like, that's what I was trying to
Unclear.
Figure out. Yeah.
Michael, do you have any other thoughts about this movie before we nominate it for some awards and play some games?
I think that those are most of my thoughts, you know? This movie needs another, like, 6 hours. I'll say it. I'll be the brave person to say it.
Miniseries this, right? Like, yeah. Netflix this shit.
It's always weird when a movie is this long, you're like, oh, I want more of it. I guess,
yeah.
I mean, is there a way, like, is there a version of this movie that works as, like, an hour 40? Like, can we cut stuff out? Mm. To make it shorter, or is it something that, like, is good enough that we just want more? Like, is there a shorter version of this that works?
I mean, cut out the part in Ireland and just start in America.
I'd buy that.
Yeah, and just kind of flesh out the boxing stuff more.
All right.
And maybe fill in a few of those gaps between the 8 months, you know, yeah. Instead of, like, starting in Ireland, just make it all about America.
Yeah, the Ireland stuff doesn't add, like, that much. I mean, I know it's the impetus for the entire movie, but, like, it doesn't add that much when you think back on it.
Yeah.
The movie kind of comes alive when she rescues him at yeah. the duel in the carriage, and then they go on the boat, and they do basically live Titanic for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And then they go to America, and then the movie really comes alive. Like,
right.
I also want to make sure that we talk about, hey, Shannon, do you like my hat? When he just buying, it's like, I can't believe he bought another hat. Love it. Just love it.
Yeah, you know, they could have always just talked about how many times he attempted to kill her father back in Ireland. Like, we didn't really need to see, like, the 9 unsuccessful. Then again, I did want, like, the whole movie of that. So.
That's definitely a really good, like, prequel. Like, we'll have our normal movie where we cut out the Ireland stuff and then just a 2-hour prequel or just him trying to kill this guy for 2.5 hours.
Mike, what about you? Any other last thoughts about Far and Away before we play some games?
Well, it's just, like, I was really surprised. Like, it was one of those movies where it felt kind of like work, you know? We get those every once in a while, and it's so spoiled with Tom Cruise's stuff. Like, he's just, every movie has just been so much fun. I was like, oh no, like, we reached the one in my mind, you know, because no one had been talking to it, you know, no one told me this is the one where he punches a horse in the face, you know.
Right.
If I'd known that, I'd been much more chipper going in, but it took me, you know, a while to really get in the groove of this, you know. He had to fall down the stairs a few times. He had to, like, fall down the stairs a lot, I guess. Once I found its groove, once they got to America, really, for me, this thing works, and it's a lot of fun, and I'm not sure if it's what they were going for is the other, you know, like, I got that in the back of my mind. Like, I'm not sure if they meant for it to play this funny. It's almost like when I used to go see Tarantino movies, like Inglourious Basterds, and I was like, wait, I'm, like, laughing through 2 hours of this, and it's like a war movie or whatever. And, like, I kind of feel the same way here. Like, I'm not sure if I should be laughing through this whole movie, but I am now, and I'm having fun, and, you know, in that regard, like, it's super entertaining, and I totally recommend it.
I think it's meant to be funny because I feel like we're laughing at things that are not unintentionally funny. Like, we're not laughing at the accents. We're not laughing at this or that. Like, I feel like the things that we're laughing at are funny moments. Maybe it's just a subversion of the expectations of what you think it's gonna be and then what it actually is. You know, like, we just, like, the last Hanks movie that we watched, or next 2 Hanks movies ago, Mike, when we did Every Time We Say Goodbye, and it starts in Jerusalem 1942, and I was like, ah, Jesus. And then that movie is exactly what I thought it was going to be.
Yes.
This is, like, I thought this was going to be that, but it's not.
Right.
And in that regard, it's such a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, agreed.
The only other thing that I want to say, is because you mentioned Back to the Future earlier, is that apparently the dress that Nicole Kidman looks at in the window in Boston when Tom Cruise buys his hat is the dress that was worn, or one of the dresses worn by Clara in the last scene in Back to the Future 3. That dress, I guess, made its way around, or maybe they had it on display here, because Back to the Future 3 was a couple years before this, so maybe they're just, like, sort of a little nod or whatever, but Back to the Future connection right there for you. So, Michael, here's a question for you. We played some games on Too Fast, Too Forever. We got some different games here.
Ooh.
We have the Tom Hanks podcast, we have this Tom Cruise podcast. Mm-hmm. If Tom Hanks were in this lead role of Joe, do you think this would have worked? What would that movie look like? Or, if that is mind-boggling and that doesn't work at all for you, what role could Tom Hanks have played in this movie instead of the Tom Cruise role?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I think my gut instinct on whether he could take over the Tom Cruise role, probably not. I already thought that there was, like, not sufficient chemistry between Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. I don't really picture Tom Hanks and Nicole Kidman having better chemistry. And I think that he doesn't have, I don't know, there is, like, a scrappiness to Tom Cruise that works in the character that I don't think Tom Hanks is, like, necessarily known for. So I guess if I had to place him as someone in the movie,
could he have played the Steven role, do you think?
Yeah, I'm trying to think about that. I guess, like, Tom Hanks can play a pretty good asshole sometimes, and that's basically all you have to do to be Steven, and there's not really, like, an age-appropriate role for him other than Steven. Otherwise, he could just be one of the, like, boxing promoter guys. I think he'd be real good at hamming it up as one of the, like, promoters for the boxing club stuff.
Yeah, because what's a little weird about this movie, especially for this game, Mike, is that, like, there's not a lot of character development across the board, and I feel like even the two main characters, like, I feel like this movie really only wants us to care about Cruise and Kidman, which is fine, but I feel like even they don't grow that much. I think it's their relationship that grows, which is kind of strange a little bit. I don't know, other than Steven, who else Tom Hanks really could play. What do you think?
It's tough. Yeah, maybe one of the boxing promoters or someone like that, or you, oh, you know what would be interesting is if you create a character where Tom Cruise has like a drinking buddy that he goes off drinking with, like, after the fighting and all that kind of stuff, and then, you know, maybe he's the comedian at the burlesque house and stuff, and, like, they strike up a relationship, and we could see him juggle and all that kind of thing, you know.
Oh, I do want to point out, we did not mention it last time, Tom Hanks does the yo-yo in Dragnet, which we had been tracking a little bit, but yeah, absolutely, the sort of vaudevillian entertainment, absolutely.
Yeah, because I just don't see him running into that place, ripping off his shirt and knocking anybody out. Like, I just, no offense, like, I don't know if Tom Hanks ever got, like, ripped for a movie. I think there's one character in Cloud Atlas that he plays for a minute that scares the shit out of me, but that's, like, as close as he ever got, I think, as, like, intimidating.
And that's the true.
Yeah. I'm going to go with that. I'm going to create a whole new character for him to play.
Yeah, I don't know where else he would kind of fit. You know, we saw him in Bosom Buddies trying to get a tattoo, and, like, when the needle... I know that his character's not always the same, but I sort of feel like it's all him to an extent, right? But, like, him just getting the one pinprick of the needle was enough to freak him out. And so I don't know that he would be boxing against guys, you know, 8 inches taller and, like, 100 pounds heavier. Like, I don't think that fits. But where do you fit? Michael, if you want a walk-on role into this movie, if you're going to be a Stan Lee cameo of sorts, where would you put yourself in this movie?
You know where I would put myself? I would put myself in that first scene when they're all, like, beating up one of the landlords who's, like, walking through the town. I would be one of the town people being like, off with his head. That's what I would be.
I love it. Mike, what about you? Where would you put yourself in here? Because, again, there's a lot of crowd scenes, but it feels like there's not a lot of times, like, opportunities really for, like, a few lines here or there.
Yeah, it's tough, really. Like, I think I want to have a spectacular crash in the land race. Like, and I'm talking, like, I got my whole family with me. Like, we've got, like, a double wagon going, and we just hit a ditch and get launched through the air like there's no tomorrow. And you just see me kind of, like, doffed my hat towards the camera, maybe in slow motion for a second, as I just kind of shrug, going like, oh, well, like, that's the end of me.
Guess I'll try Kansas.
Yeah, on to the next state.
You know what I feel that would be funny kind of in that regard? You know, Tom Cruise is about to plant the flag, and then he and Steven are battling, and they tumble on the horse. I think it'd be funny if they had a character like me in the background who's just like, ooh, this looks like a good spot. And, like, he, like, creeps a little bit toward the flag. It's just like, maybe not. And then just, like, sort of backs out of frame. Like, just, you know, have a third guy in there. Because, like, Nicole Kidman just looking on. But just have somebody else there like, oh, this is, maybe not.
Like, what's going on over here? Okay, I'm moving along.
Exactly.
Yeah, like, respecting people having a moment. Being like, all right, y'all are going through some stuff. Good for you. I'm going to find another flag.
Exactly. So we have an email address here on the show, run@cageclub.me. And Mike, we have an email from past and future guest, Christian Larson.
Oh, no way. Awesome.
Subject line, born on the 4th of July. So we email us to run@cageclub.me. He writes his email, hey guys, long time, first time. Well, Larson, welcome to the family. I recently listened to your podcast on Born on the 4th of July and figured I'd share a story about the first time I saw it. My apologies if it's lengthy. This is back in my high school days. Actually, Michael, have you seen Born on the 4th of July or no?
No.
So it's a movie where Tom Cruise plays a really sort of...
Yeah, it's the Vietnam War vet, right?
Exactly. He's all about... He's rah-rah patriotic, goes to Vietnam.
Ron Kovic or whatever his name is.
Yep. Gets paralyzed, comes back, sort of gets disillusioned, becomes this outspoken anti-Vietnam person. So that's
activist,
sort of the context of this movie. So Larson says, back in my high school days, I had a history teacher named Mr. Note. He was an avid outdoorsman, boxing enthusiast, maybe you've seen this movie, maybe you like this one, an athletic coach, not to mention a former police commissioner and town councilman. But perhaps most notably, to me anyway, he was in charge of our school's debate team. Every now and then he'd pull our class on a contentious topic. Whatever the prevailing opinion was, he would always argue the opposite so convincingly we'd all feel like idiots. It helped that we were almost always wrong. One day, our class was told about how Jimmy Carter had pardoned people who traveled to Canada to escape the Vietnam draft, and were asked how we felt about it. Overwhelmingly, the class disapproved, and in response, Mr. Note showed us Born on the 4th of July. Larson says, hearing you both describe your response to the film took me back to sitting in that classroom and being unprepared not just for the intensity of the movie and Cruise's performance, but the questions it raised about what it means to be an American. This was not a movie high school kids were usually shown, especially not sheltered upper-middle-class suburban kids, still riding a wave of patriotism after the Gulf War. I learned later that Mr. Note was having conversations like this since he started teaching in the 70s, and I can only imagine how passionate the debate was back then. I only had him for one semester, but Mr. Note really expanded my thinking more than almost any other teacher I ever had, and Born on the 4th of July was a big part of that. Thanks for reminding me of him, and as usual, for a great podcast. He says, the legend of Big Al Note ended appropriately in 2012 with his health in decline. His friends and family held a legendary party to celebrate his life in lieu of a funeral. He passed away that night. You know, I've had great teachers. I don't think I've ever had a teacher that showed me a movie. You know, like, I feel like that's such a killer argument to have. Like, just like, oh, you think that you know what you're talking about? Like, watch this movie. Like, this is, like, based on a real guy. Then let me know what you think. And I think, Mike, you and I both loved Born on the 4th of July. And I think to have a teacher show a class of students, like, so impressionable at that age, a movie like that is powerful. Like, that's a statement.
I mean, even at my age, at 39, it was enlightening. You know what I mean? Like, it affected me in a lot of ways that, you know, I was like, wow, I'm still learning from movies. Like, this is great.
Well, Larson, thank you for writing in. I'm glad that we could sort of rekindle those or stir up those memories in your brain. Mr. Note sounds awesome. Shout out, Mr. Note. And if you want to write in about either, you know, a movie that we've talked about, a movie that we're going to talk about, podcast, Tom Cruise, whatever, run@cageclub.me. All right, so obviously, very important, the answer is yes. Does Tom Cruise run in this movie? Yeah, he runs to the Ozarks.
Yeah.
And then he even sprints to the landmarker toward the end there when he's off the horse.
And he tries to, like, run down the stairs, and he falls.
Now, an equally important question, I don't know if the answer is yes or not. Michael, we found a guy on Twitter, Har Perfect, who said, you can swap out Tom Cruise's name in any movie with Lightning McQueen, and it works just as well. Do you think if Far and Away starred Tom Cruise as Lightning McQueen, it is Irish?
Yeah.
Would it have worked?
It is Irish.
Yeah. It
sounds, I think, kind of.
Like, this movie's so goofy that, like, why wouldn't that? It would be like Lightning. You know, his name's really Tommy, but we call him Lightning, and everyone would be like, hey. Yeah. So I think it would work.
Yeah, it would be the perfect nickname for his ring name, right?
Lightning Fist McQueen.
Yeah.
It's excellent. Because especially since how quickly he knocks people out when he starts.
Oh, yeah. He kind of reminded me a little bit of Brad Pitt in Snatch, where it's just like the one punch and he goes down. In like equally gritty, grimy sort of undergroundy clubs. But yeah, so yes. For how serious this movie, in theory, is, Lightning McQueen, absolutely. Okay, time to nominate this for awards. I feel like we're going to... I think, you know, it's not necessarily the best, not my favorite movie that we've done, but there's so much in here that is so specifically, Mike, what we cover, that I feel like it's gonna rack up a lot of awards in that regard. So maybe the Golden Oak Leaves, maybe the Golden Sunglasses, whatever it is. Best film, I'm okay leaving it off. I think it's great, but I think considering what we already have here, or actually, you know,
I think I'm not going best film because I feel like there's stuff missing, right? Like, that to me is the mark of, like, best film is, like, I feel complete, like, I'm good to go, I don't need any more, maybe, or I'll just rewatch it to this, like we've been kind of saying throughout, like, we can spread this out a little longer.
That's fair. And I think in that same regard, Ron Howard for Best Filmmaker is kind of close, but if he had sort of put out this 4-hour epic, yes, as it stands right now, it's very good, but not necessarily on par with Tony Scott or Oliver Stone or Scorsese or Barry Levinson or whatever.
Is this our first crossover director between this and Splash?
Ooh, maybe, probably.
That's fascinating. Such wildly different movies that tailored toward these two actors' like strengths at the time.
Best Cruise role. Now, Michael, I know that you haven't seen everything that we've done, but in terms of what you have seen of Tom Cruise's career, do you think, does this role stack up with the best of the best of his roles throughout his career?
Probably not, but I mean, like, he's fine in it. I just don't think it wouldn't crack my like top five, probably.
Okay. And Mike, what about you?
We haven't really mentioned it too much, I guess it didn't seem to bother you too much, but the accents.
Oh, I didn't mind it. Like, I just sort of settled into it. I was just like, this is what it is. this is where we live now.
It kept kind of pulling me out from time to time, if I got to be honest about it. Like, not that they weren't sustaining it, but just that I was just like, it's just kind of weird to hear it coming out of Tom Cruise for so long. Like, Nicole Kidman was a little more natural because she does have an accent. Like, she is Australian. Like, she does speak with an actual accent and stuff, but yeah, I don't know. There's just something about that I couldn't quite get over.
All right, that's fair. I also had read that a lady of her status in Ireland would most likely speak with an English accent, like a very high-class, upper-crusty British accent, but people thought that that would confuse audiences, so they had her speak sort of in an upper-crusty Irish accent, which is not historically accurate, but, you know, so there's a little bit of confusion there, too.
As long as we're on accents real quick, and Ron Howard, for that matter, Bryce Dallas Howard in Rocketman, has anyone seen that yet? But
that
is an accent for the ages. Oh boy. That's all I'll say. I don't want to give anything else away, but that came out of nowhere.
It is. It's a choice. It's certainly a choice.
I feel like accents never really bother me. Like, I don't know. I feel like people always complain about like Emma Watson and like people like that who do like American accents or vice versa. I like never notice. I don't know what it is about me, but I'm like, I don't know. I assume that's just how they talk, I guess. And then I just move on. Like, it's never, I can't even think of a movie where I'm like, that person had such a bad accent. And now I'm trying to think of one.
I think I've probably noticed it, but I think for the most part, it doesn't usually bother me. Like, I think it's just like, oh, this is, like, there's other things that I think, like, the fact that this is Tom Cruise in a movie that's set in Ireland in 1892, that could take you out of, you know what I mean? Like, I know it's all acting to a certain extent. I don't know.
Like, the only thing I can think of, it's because it's when I can't really place the accent. Like, whatever Amy Adams is doing in American Hustle, I have no idea what it is. And I think that's much more confusing. Whereas if someone's like, this is my Irish accent, I'm like, all right, they tried. Like, whatever. But, like, when it's so confusing and, like, not really discernible where they're supposed to be from, I think that's when I get a little bit more. I'm like, this is kind of noticeable and distracting.
That's fair. I think I mostly agree with you there. Most badass role, I'm going to say yes, because he punches a horse and punches a bunch of dudes. I don't know how it can't be most badass role. Also, the same thing, best fight, Joe versus the horse. We're going to have Joe versus the volcano over on Hanks for the Memories, but Joe versus a horse here, that's a pretty goddamn good fight.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like awestruck by that moment still when I think about it. That how did they shoot it? What were like the animal rights people thinking when they were approached with this concept and everything? Just like all the minor details. I want a behind the scenes on just that shot. You know, like, forget the rest of the movie.
Best theme song soundtrack score. I think it's sort of generically, like, it's good. It's nice. I don't want to, you know, talk ill about it or whatever, but I just think it's not necessarily memorable.
Well, you know, there's a lot of that, like, yep. Like, it's most, I'm like, oh, God, make it stop.
Best car chase or race? I'm going to say yes, the race to the land grab, right?
Yeah, one of the best yet.
One of the original car races, if you will.
There you go, that's the first Fast and the Furious.
Yeah, the prequel we deserve.
Pit stop. Best dance scene? Do they dance? I guess they dance.
Well, burlesque
dance.
Well, because there's one point where, doesn't she say, like, are we dancing? But I don't think it's, like, necessarily memorable like the other things we've had so far in Cruise Club.
Yeah, it's not memorable.
It's no risky business. Like, that's
the burlesque could have been explored way more than
it was. Oh, sure.
She shows up for literally one night only.
Special engagement, Michael. One night only. Yeah. Best cruise outfit or wardrobe? I mean, I sort of like seeing, or do we say naked with a bowl over his junk? Is that an outfit? I guess, sort of.
Oh, that counts.
Yeah. That's hilarious. I mean, it's just something so ridiculous about that.
It's wonderful. Best sunglasses? I guess this predates sunglasses?
I guess so. Who invented those? Ben Franklin? I don't know.
Best death? I mean, he doesn't wind up dead, but he does die. Well, so I'm gonna nominate this for best death for sure.
I mean, any death you come back from is pretty good, right?
That's always the best one, the one you come back from.
Now the question here, I don't think he really has the best freak out, I don't think, but best line, is it gonna be this is a difficult murder, Shannon all Chester equal in the eyes of the Lord? Is it gonna be this land is mine by destiny? Is it gonna be I feel myself dying? Or is it going to be, and I don't think it's going to be this one, but that's just the line that I bolded. I think this is the night that he runs out to beat up the dude in the middle of the night. Nicole Kidman, like, sits up in bed and she says to him, am I beautiful at all? And he just says, I've never seen anything like you in my living life. And then she says, good. And then just, like, rolls over and goes to bed. Like, what a cock tease there. I think there's got to be a line from here that we nominate for best line. but I don't know what it should be.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I've been getting bad at writing down, like, standout lines and stuff, but, man, this movie is full of them.
Michael, do you have a favorite? Do you have one that sort of stands out to you among the rest?
It's tough, because I remember him saying something, but I can't remember the exact line. But there's the part when he comes out of the horse stable in the beginning, and he basically tells her dad, like, prepare to die, basically. I kind of like that moment, but I can't remember exactly what he says to him. So if I had to choose from something that I actually remember, I mean, the Land Destiny stuff is a little too cheesy. I kind of like the ones about him talking about his own death. I like those a little bit more.
There is a line early on that we didn't talk about, that when his dad comes back from the dead, his dad says to him, you're an odd boy. And he says, you came back from the dead to tell me that I'm odd? And I was like, what? All right.
Oh, yeah, that was funny.
So maybe I feel myself dying, or...
It is kind of crazy.
I feel myself dying. Best sex scene? No, there's not really a sex scene here.
Wait,
most athletic feat? Taming a wild horse or chasing down the land grab or like boxing? Like what is the most athletic feat or running to the Ozarks? Like there's a lot of athleticism in this movie. What's the most athletic feat in this movie?
When you said that, I literally thought you meant F-E-E-T. And I was like, what? What movies have you been watching where you're like, wow, the feet were so athletic?
Well, Michael, we know that feet are big on the internet and we're just trying to appeal to that demographic.
Honestly, yeah, you'd get a lot of listeners, you know? So you might as well change it while I'm here.
Because what people love more than looking at feet is listening about it. Listening to people
talk about it, yeah.
But what's the most athletic thing that he does? Because there's a lot of things he does. What's the most athletic thing he does in this movie?
I mean, is this a cop-out to say coming back from the dead is pretty impressive? Like, ooh. I don't know if I would have, like, the willpower to do... I'd be like, all right, I guess I'm gone.
I mean...
Pretty athletic.
Punching a horse... takes a pretty strong fist to do that, I think.
Taming a horse via punching is what I'm going to say.
Like, there's a lot. I feel like he does a lot in this movie. Really pushes his physicality. Like, I wonder, did it mention if he did any of his own riding and all that kind of stuff? Because, like, you know, he loves, even back then, he's a big stunt guy. Oh, and there's also a moment in here where he quotes about chocolate cake and made me think of Outsiders.
Ooh, oh yeah. He loves his chocolate cake in the Outsiders.
Oh, wait, I have the quote. I think the quote has to be the thing about asking Shannon if he likes the hat. If she likes the hat.
Yeah.
And then she's like, you're not wearing a hat. And he's like, do you like my hat?
Okay. Best running scene, obviously running to the Ozarks.
Yeah, of course.
Best or worst love story? I feel like it's, again, kind of in the middle. Like, I don't think it's as bad as the one in Cocktail, which is just,
that's the
problematic
worst.
In a bunch of ways. Oof. I feel like this is just, like, undeveloped in a way. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I don't think it's bad. I just think it's kind of neutral-ish.
Just kind of ignored and forgotten and not explored, really, yeah.
Best ensemble cast, no, because there's only, like, two people that we know. I'm going to say here, best non-cruise actor female, I'm going to put down Nicole Kidman for both, but this, but also more specifically, eventually, for Eyes Wide Shut, because we know that she's going to get nominated for that, so this is sort of the kickoff to the nomination for that, ultimately. So right now we have 9 awards, most badass role, best fight, best car chase, best outfit or wardrobe, best death, best line, most athletic feat, best running scene, and then Nicole Kidman. Is there anything else about this movie that we enjoyed or hated so much that we want to make sure that we nominated for? I think we're pretty good, but is there something that we missed that we want to give credit to?
No, I'm pretty good. That's a lot.
I mean, cool. Do you have like a general like best cinematography or something?
We have that on other shows. I don't think we have that on here
yet. I think we were trying
yet.
To sort of... as much as possible, regulate it to the actual, like, actors that we're trying to cover, right, Joey? Because, like, I think at one time where we were doing, like, Keanu or Charlize, like, we started doing director, cinematographer, these other things. And it was fun, but at the end of the day, we really just wanted to whittle it down to Cruise and Hanks.
Yeah, because what happens, Michael, is that we have already, like, 25 categories, and we don't want to have this many at the end, so we sort of pare things down, and we sort of remove categories entirely, and... I think what we've learned over doing 5 or 6 of these already is just to sort of focus on the stuff that's about the actor that we're covering and then sort of go from there. So I think this movie does look really nice. I think it's sort of, it does have an appropriately epic feel. And I think that the camera captures that. But I think just know, like, we're probably going to cut the best filmmaker thing, I think, eventually, just because it's not Cruise. Like, it's kind of like a, oh yeah, he got hired by this guy or whatever. You know what I mean? So, but anyway, tell our listeners, if they're still around, about your podcast. Because I feel like, you're going to be on a Cruise episode at some point with the woman from your first season. And I know you're for sure you're going to be on a Hanks for the Memories episode about the woman from your first season. But why don't you tell everyone listening about Not Her Again?
We covered the career of an actress in a couple different ways. So our first season we did Meryl Streep, and the way we looked at Meryl Streep's career was we looked at every time she lost an Oscar, and we basically looked at like why she lost, what she was up against, that kind of thing. Then in our second season we covered the career of Julia Roberts. We kind of just did that one a little bit more chronologically. I mean, I guess losing Oscars is chronological also, but like we just kind of grouped her movies together, like when she did her breakout stuff, when she did the rom-coms of the late 90s, when she did the Oscar baity stuff, like all that kind of stuff. And then in our upcoming season, which has been delayed mostly because of me, and by mostly I mean 100% because of me, because I control it, I'm trying to shift blame onto, I'm like, oh, I guess it's mostly my fault, but other people too, it's literally entirely my fault.
We know it's Walter.
Yeah, exactly. It's former guest Walt Hickey, who does not record his end of the podcast. In our upcoming season, I feel like last time I was really coy about like who it was going to cover, and I kind of like doing that, even though I think Walter already told people who we were covering on another one of your podcasts, but I'm still just going to give a hint, because I think it's fun, and people can piece it together. Everyone's like, we're not taking the time to do that.
So here's the thing. So the last time, so when you're on Too Fast, Too Forever, the hint that you gave was that she was not around or she was not alive to collect her Oscar, right?
Yeah, it's that she never physically accepted her Oscar.
Can you give another clue about her?
My other clue about her will be her mom is one of the like original founders of what eventually became like Planned Parenthood.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. That's very cool.
Yeah, that's a fun one.
Mike, do you know who
they're
we're talking
interesting
about?
Bunch.
I thought I did until that clue, but can I mention who I thought?
Yeah, we have Leap Technology.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, her mom was responsible for that long ago?
Yeah, her mom was like part of the group that organized, I think the organization that then became Planned Parenthood, but like it wasn't called that then. But yeah, she was like a big contraceptives rights activist.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Yeah, because Joey, I think that came up when we were talking about The Aviator at one point with Walt for a second.
Such a good scene when they go to house.
Yes.
You mean The Aviator starring serious actor turned comedic actor turned serious actor again, Adam Scott?
Exactly.
Wow. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a great movie. I love that movie.
I have not seen it. I think I bought it at least once, if not twice. I've not seen it because I'm daunted by a 3-hour movie, even though, you know,
Wait, you haven't seen The Aviator?
No. I should.
It's cool. I like it. It's kind of breezy, too. Like, it's Scorsese. It's, you know, it flies by.
It's a breezy 3-hour. No, I guess he does have breezy 3-hour movies, but still.
No, it's really good. I recently rewatched it and was like, that was so good. And I would watch 3 more hours of it.
Yeah, I think Leo and Scorsese are great together. So,
yeah.
It's really good.
Well, Michael, I hope that I make you happy, because last night I decided, because today's episode, as we're recording this, last Tuesday, as you're listening to this, the episode of The Contenders that came out is about my best friend's wedding. And so I decided, while listening to that episode, that I'm going to celebrate Julia Roberts and watch 5 of her movies. I'm going to watch 5 that I've never seen before. Hook, Best Friend's Wedding, Mystic Pizza, Notting Hill, and Pretty Woman, and also Homecoming, the series. So I'm going to watch those and sort of embrace the Julia Roberts that I know that I love, but I just have not seen a lot of the stuff. So do you think that's is that a good basis for picks?
Yeah, no, those are, I mean, I actually have never seen Hook because I don't, that's like, I feel like less of a Julia Roberts movie, more of like a Dustin Hoffman, Robin Williams movie.
I just want to see her as Tinkerbell. Like, I think that's weird enough and cool enough on its own, but again, I have no interest otherwise, but yeah.
Yeah. And Hook is also kind of long. So I'm like, but Mystic Pizza is like a movie where Walter and I, for when we were starting the season, we obviously started with Mystic Pizza because that's kind of her first big role. And we, like, turned to each other after, and we were like, because we thought it was going to be kind of corny and stupid, and we turned to each other after, and we were like, was that did you really enjoy that also? Because I, like, very, like, on a very genuine level, I, like, was really invested in that. Wait, so have you seen My Best Friend's Wedding yet?
No.
Ah! That's, like, probably my favorite, that would be my top 5 movies of all time. Like, I love My Best Friend's Wedding. So I really need your take on that after.
Okay.
Notting Hill is really good. I think My Best Friend's Wedding is more controversial. Notting Hill, I think, is a little bit more generic, and people really... I mean, I really love that movie, too. I just think it plays it safer. My Best Friend's Wedding is, I think, a very subversive rom-com. And Pretty Woman's great. I mean, you have to start with the classics, you know?
Sure. You know, I've seen her in a bunch of things, but I think, like, one of the all-time great performances, like, with a capital G, is Erin Brockovich. Like,
oh,
I think
I'm so glad you said that.
A powerhouse in that movie. Like, it's unbelievable how goddamn good she is in that movie.
Literally, the night I finished law school, I watched Erin Brockovich because I was like, I need something to make me feel good about my decisions. And Erin Brockovich is so good. I think that for me, the 3 performances of hers that always stick out, and you're going to see 2 of them now, you'll have all 3, is My Best Friend's Wedding, Erin Brockovich, and I loved her in Homecoming, so I'm super excited to get your take on that also. I think that those are probably three of her best performances ever.
Very cool.
And then Larry Crown over on Hanks for the Memories.
Okay, Larry Crown's like a good movie.
I called it a hangover movie. Like, I think I watched it one day when I got back from Vegas, and I like just landed, and it was on when I got home, and I just like watched it and then fell asleep.
It's like so aggressively pleasant and benign. It's like great.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us on this episode to watch this very long, very very long movie, but also should have been longer. But thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Always fun.
For all things Cruise Club, you can go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Oh, actually, hold on. Pump the brakes. I want to say this because I did the work. Mike, I forgot it last time, but next up, we're doing A Few Good Men, right? Tom Cruise nominated for Golden Globe for Best Actor in that movie. So I forgot it the last time we did it, but did not win, but Golden Globe nominated for Best Actor in this movie. So it's a big one. Resuming my outro, cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, like Larson did, run@cageclub.me. Check out our Patreon page, our Threadless shop, and just poke around. Every Friday we have a Tom Club episode, Cruise Club, Hanks of the Memories. You can go get Not Her Again wherever you get this podcast. Still waiting for season 3 with who knows who it's going to be about. I mean, Mike and I do, but you know, or just listen to our Risky Business episode where I think Walt blabs it. So just go do that. But anyway, I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Michael Domenico of the Not Her Again podcast. And we'll see you in 2 weeks for the Golden Globe nominated role in A Few Good Men right here on Cruise Club.
Like it's most. I'm like, oh God, make it stop.